Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Hey, Robert. What's your favorite possession movie?
Ooh, well, there's so many. I guess I've reached the point where I'm not as into demon possession. I want a movie about robots possessing people or alien entities possessing people. Or, of course, weird angelic Christ figures from another planet possessing people, such as in Larry Cohen's God Told Me To.
Oh, yeah, there you go. How about in maybe my favorite is The Visitor.
Ooh.
You know, that one. Filmed in Atlanta in the 1970s.
Yes.
You get to see the old highways and everything, but it's got that Italian sheen. And there's a little girl who gets possessed by, I think, a Satan from another planet.
Oh, yeah. John Huston's in that one, right?
Yeah. And I think a very disoriented Sam Peckinpah plays a doctor in it.
Cool. Well, you know, another one that comes to mind is the Toho horror film Matango. Are you familiar with this one?
I know about it because you've mentioned it, but I've never seen it.
Oh, it's a fabulous story about a weird fungus on essentially a monster island. It's probably somewhere in the region of Monster Island,
like the King Kong.
Yeah,
one. Yeah.
And it this fungus takes over people's bodies and gradually turns them into not only fungi infested humanoid monsters, but into a straight up walking mushroom of death.
That's awesome, but to what end? Like, what do mushrooms want that they can't get on their own and they need a human body for?
Well, you know, mushrooms need to move around. Mushrooms, of course, just need to reproduce and spread and continue the genetic mission. And sometimes that involves, in fiction, walking on two legs, or in reality, walking on, say, six legs.
Whoa. And that brings us to our topic today. Robert, I would say this is one that has been frequently requested by listeners, I think. It's a topic that if you're one of these parasite fan geeks, like a lot of you out there are, mm-hmm. we know you've probably heard of this before, but we've gotten a lot of requests and it's a great topic. We've never devoted a full episode to it before, so I think it's finally time to talk about Ophiocordyceps.
That's right, especially since there's actually an update to the story.
Yeah.
That's the really exciting part here is that Because we've touched on it before on past episodes, but this time we get to cover it in more depth and discuss the latest information. And the cool thing about the update is that it's definitely a positive one.
I notice very often, because we try to practice responsible scientific skepticism on the show, that whenever you get an update to a sensational science story, mm-hmm. more often than not, the update is that really sensational thing you learned last year actually is wrong.
Right. And now, you know, I can see where that can turn people off every now and then. I mean, sometimes it's something like, oh, Pluto has lost its planetary status, and you feel a little hurt by that.
Yeah, sad trombone.
Yeah. Or a big one that I've noticed with people is finding out or being told that, say, a Tyrannosaurus Rex had feathers.
Yeah.
And then that kind of destroys your childhood dream or your cinematic vision of what a T-Rex should be. I think we are both in agreement that dinosaurs with feathers are cool.
And actually scarier.
Yeah, and scarier, especially if they're
fuzzy,
covered in fuzz. Yeah.
Yes, a fuzzy Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know this to be true in your heart, is scarier than one with just regular lizard scales.
Yeah, but I have to say, this case with Ophiocordyceps, this is not a case of feathered dinosaurs. This is a case of the new scientific information making an already terrifying scenario even more frightening, and an already complex system of parasitism even more complicated.
Absolutely. So before we lather up your brain with those nightmares, I figure we should take a look generally at behavior-controlling parasites as a sort of class of organism.
Right.
Because that's where the Ophiocordyceps really gets its reputation, is the fact that it is a fungus that has some control over the behavior of its host.
Right.
And it's not the only organism like this in the world.
Oh, no. There are numerous examples that we could spend a great deal of time going through. Not even all of them, but just some of the key examples. We're not going to do that. We're going to hit, like, maybe three, I think. But the thing is, you have to, in a way, you have to appreciate these simpler models of mind control parasites in order to appreciate what is essentially the Mona Lisa of mind control parasites.
Its eyes follow you no matter where you go.
Yeah, well, and it's just the pinnacle of complexity and beauty if you find organisms of this sort beautiful.
Also, like the Mona Lisa, surrounded by people taking pictures of it constantly.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so this first one we're going to look at is one you've probably heard of before because it is the result of a panic, and I will have to debunk one of the creepier parts of the panic about this, but the organism itself still is very cool. So this is going to be Toxoplasma gondii.
Yes.
This is a microbial protozoan parasite. It's responsible for the disease toxoplasmosis in animals, and lots of humans and pets are today already infected with T. gondii. They get infected at some point in their lives, but there's only one known animal host that allows this parasite to achieve sexual reproduction. And that host is, of course, our lord and master, the common cat. It might be inside you right now, but if so, it's not having sex. It's only having sex if it's in your cat.
Yeah, and it's kind of like with people that travel around. You're more inclined to look after your home, I guess. And then if you're staying in a hotel or a guest house, then, you know, who cares? You can just wreck the place. That's kind of what occurs with T. gondii.
Yeah,
is that the cat alone is unaffected. It's every other species that seems to be warped to some degree by its occupancy.
Right. So if you're imagining what life is like as a parasite, you might think, hey, it's great. I can infect all kinds of organisms. But that's not necessarily great, is it? Because what if you need to get into a cat to reproduce, mm-hmm. but you're stuck in some other organism? You've infected a human or something like that. You're basically going nowhere.
Right. So many of these parasitic cycles, and I love looking at illustrations of these cycles. It's kind of a careful platforming video game. You have to jump from here to here to here in order to complete this cycle. And if you miss that jump, you're toast. And also, if you jump to the wrong organism, you're potentially toast. Or if you wind up in the right organism but end up in the wrong portion of it, you're potentially toast, and so is the host.
Right. So let's chart those jumps. Let's say you are a colony of T. gondii, and you're stuck inside a rat. And you've got a hankering for some sexual reproduction. What are you going to do? Like, you don't have a way to hop out of the rat and go looking for a litter box to stake out.
Right.
You don't have legs, so you've got to find some way to get the rat into the cat.
Yeah, you've got to essentially steer Starship Rat into the cat.
And for a while, it was hypothesized that parasites like this might actually control the behavior of the host in order to get where they needed to go. And in the case of rats infected with T. gondii, recent studies have shown that this is exactly what happens. So I want to look at one study published in the year 2000 in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of London B, Biological Sciences. And this was by Manuel Berdoy, Joanne Webster, and David McDonald. And this is called Fatal Attraction in Rats Infected with Toxoplasma gondii. So the study tested the exploration behavior of rats infected with T. gondii and a control group of uninfected rats in an outdoor pen during the night. And in these pens, there were areas marked with various odors. So you'd have a neutral smell. This would be clean straw bedding. A, quote, own smell, like your own smell, which is the rat's own straw bedding. You can probably guess this smelled like the rat's own urine.
Mm-hmm.
You had a rabbit smell, which was rabbit urine, and you had a cat smell, which was cat urine. And what did they find? Well, unsurprisingly, the control rats, the rats that did not have the toxoplasma infection, paid a lot of visits to the areas marked with their own smell, but they really tended to avoid the areas that smelled like cat urine. You don't want to hang out where your worst nightmare takes bathroom breaks. But the T. gondii-infected rats made way more visits to the cat urine-marked areas. The way the researchers described this, it wasn't just that the parasite infection made them less afraid of cats. It manifested as a kind of bizarre suicidal attraction to the smell of cats. So it looks like what's happening is that T. gondii manipulates the behavior of its rat hosts, causing them to wander around in cat country until they get eaten. And then when the cat eats the rat contains tissue cysts of the T. gondii that infect the cat, and then the protozoan can finally get around to some sexual reproduction. And I think this is interesting because it's a really devious trick, but one that strikes me as not necessarily complicated within the rat.
Yeah, it's kind of a flipping of a switch, the reversal of a setting.
Yeah, I think it's possible that all you'd have to do here is find a way to turn off the avoidance component of the rat's natural fear response. And once you've done that, the arousal component of the fear response, unchecked by avoidance, could sort of lead to these suicidal type behaviors on its own.
Now, that alone is pretty fascinating. I've written about toxo, it seems like, countless times over the past 10 years or so. And I'm always just intrigued by that basic concept. But some have taken it even further and have looked at what is toxo potentially doing to humans.
Yeah, and for many years, I think there was legitimate worry that, well, if it does this in rats, is Toxoplasma gondii leading to some cases of human mental illness or risky behavior patterns in humans? It's a reasonable thing to wonder about, but I do want to quash the panic here. Given more recent research, I think it's unlikely because, so there was a 2016 paper by Karen Sugden et al. Published in PLOS1, and it tried to track the effects of Toxoplasma seropositivity in a sample of 837 subjects, 28% of whom were positive. And other than an extremely small average increase in the number of suicide attempts, there was no measurable psychological difference in humans with Toxoplasma infection and those without. And the suicide attempt difference is small enough that it, you know, could be noise. To quote from their conclusions, quote, on the whole, there was little evidence that T. gondii was related to increased risk of psychiatric disorder, poor impulse control, personality aberrations, or neurocognitive impairment. So don't worry too much about the toxoplasma in yourself.
Yeah, that's good because like I say, I've covered toxo enough over the past 10 years, and I've been a cat owner over the past 10 years. So you can't help but fall into some, at times, almost kind of supernatural thinking about it. You're like, well, there might be nothing to this, but if there is, I sure am around a cat a lot. And then you start like second guessing all your motivations in your life and your behavior, wondering just how much of you is in your actions, how much of it can be blamed upon the cat.
Why can't I stop gambling? It's my cat.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to roll through some more examples before we move on to our prime brain hijacker today.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, all right, we're back. So this is another favorite of mine, and I've actually told stories about it, like personal accounts of this parasite in the past on the podcast, but I'll spare everyone the actual tales. But what I want to talk about are parasitoids from the phylum Nematomorpha. They're also known as horsehair worms because these thread-like round worms resemble the hair of a horse's tail or mane. And as larvae, they take up residence inside a cricket, a mantis, a beetle, or other host organism. But as adults, they're free-living organisms that live generally in like shallow pools of water or really damp soil.
Okay.
Now, male and female horsehair worms mate in that damp soil or the fresh water, and then the females lay millions of eggs. So we have a similar situation, though, about these eggs need to go somewhere. They need to complete this cycle.
You need to get from one place to another, but you can't crawl there.
Yes. So these eggs, what they do is they hatch, and then the tiny larvae insist on vegetation near the water's edge. So that, they form these like hard structures.
So that's E-N-C-Y-S-T, not I-N-S-I-S-T.
Right. Yeah, they can't insist upon anything, but they can insist a leaf.
Okay.
So they're on the leaf, and then up pops a cricket or other suitable host, drops by, and it eats this insisted larva along with the vegetation.
Yum.
Or in the cases of, say, a carnivorous mantis, it acquires the parasite by devouring an already infected intermediate host, such as a mosquito larva.
Okay.
Now, once inside its target host, the cyst covering dissolves, and it allows the juvenile worm to escape, bore through the gut wall, and start absorbing nutrients. And then it grows and grows, just becoming just a longer and thicker worm inside the creature. Just, you imagine it just coiled and coiled inside the body cavity.
So if you're the insect, it's like, congratulations, you've got a new major organ.
Right. Yeah. It's essentially a xenomorph. It grows until it's time to just burst out. Here's the thing. It'll certainly abandon ship if the host dies. Mm-hmm. And that's what I have observed in the past. Like, somebody stomps a cricket in band class because they think the cricket's gross, and then this disgusting organism emerges from the cricket.
Whoa.
Yeah. But of course, it doesn't want to emerge on the floor of your band room. It wants to emerge, near fresh water or damp soil.
Okay.
So how does it get there? Well, there are two theories here. One is that the worm instills a crazed thirst in the host so that it seeks out water.
So it's like, I'm so thirsty, I must go to a large body of water?
Right.
Okay.
And then the second theory is that the worm simply waits until the host finds water on its own, and then it bursts forth.
Okay.
So
it's like, I detect that your body is filling up with liquid right now. It's time to jump out.
Yeah, it must be in an area with liquid. I shall jump out now and hopefully find the habitat I need. Now, according to a 2001 paper from the German journal Zoologische Anzeiger, the thirst hypothesis is supported by observations of suicidal behavior in infected mantises in southern France that seemingly jump into the river and give birth to the worm that consumes them. And by the way, sometimes it's twins.
Oh,
yeah. Sometimes they don't have one enormous nematode growing inside them. They have two.
So you can't really, on the second hypothesis, just waiting until it's drinking, explain all the, like, suicidal jumping into water.
Right. So it seems like there's reason to lean in the direction of mind control, mind manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it is, as with the rat and toxo, seemingly fairly simple.
Yeah.
Like, make your host feel thirstier than normal when you are ready to emerge and find water.
Well, I admit that's a good one, but how about some parasitic wasps?
Oh, well, I certainly love parasitic wasps. I love wasps and bees in general, and I continue to find tremendous joy in the fact that my 5-year-old son's only imaginary friends are his, quote, bee and wasp friends.
So what?
He has two bees and two wasps.
Are they normal-sized or are they larger than normal?
They're normal size, and
okay.
They live on his head or sometimes are flying around his head. And I'll forget that they're there, and then suddenly he'll bring them up. And I presume they are always there to him.
Now, are they anthropomorphic? Do they speak?
No.
No?
No. I think
the
only difference is that they don't sting, except they will sting like monsters or bad guys or something.
Nice.
I think that's been explained to me. But otherwise, they're just animals. So I really like that. But as into bees and wasps as my son is, I don't think he's ready for the truly diabolical examples of parasitic wasps that really outbody our grimmest nightmares. All right. Well, so just a little background. Prehistoric parasitic wasps. As far back as the Jurassic period, they would use their pointy ovipositors, which is a female-only reproductive structure, to lay eggs directly onto living insects such as caterpillars, which the hatching larva would then consume. But why lay your eggs on a caterpillar when with a little evolution, you can lay them directly inside your victim?
Nice.
Essentially, you're using that ovipositor as a surgical device. So it grows into a sharp, sometimes sawtoothed instrument that helps a wasp better perform the necessary surgery. And since the chosen insect hosts tend to take offense and fight off the wasp's advances, the ovipositors also evolve to pack a venomous punch. And so, like, the end result is you see something like a honeybee, which doesn't engage in this kind of parasitic activity at all, but still retains a potent ovipositor.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Now, a number of modern parasitic wasps continue this very practice, though, either peppering the outsides or filling the bodies of their hosts with sometimes dozens of eggs. Other wasps evolved away from the practice, but even with them, the venomous stinger remains. No longer an instrument of reproduction, but a potent biological weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the examples of parasitic wasp egg-laying are rather straightforward, while others are just really diabolical, such as the case of Deinocampus coccinellae, a common parasitic wasp of the spotted lady beetle, Coleomegala maculata. So the essential reproductive strategy here is much the same with many other species of parasitic wasps. She uses her ovipositor to surgically implant her egg inside the body of the chosen host organism.
Uh-huh.
But where this gets crazy, though, is when the actual emergence occurs, what you might refer to as a chestburst mitzvah, if you will. that's when it gets really weird and noteworthy. So normally, you would expect a host organism to mercifully die at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it goes down in the Alien movies, right? Once the xenomorph has emerged from your body, you blessedly expire.
Right. You're not walking around for a few days with it poking out of your stomach.
Right. Though that would be a fun Halloween costume, I guess, with a puppet built in. But where this example gets weird, though, is that not only does the host organism live, not only does the ladybug live, but a little behavior modification forces it to hang around and quote-unquote guard its parasite baby as it grows into adulthood beneath its protective bulk.
Huh.
And scientists believe that what's happening here is the secretions left by the larva when it bursts out might play a role in reprogramming the host.
Wow.
And then you would think, all right, well, finally the ladybug gets to die.
Uh-huh.
But, you would think surely it's suffered enough and it can just, it can be at peace. But there's no such luck. Because, you know, this is the insect world and things are a bit cruel and weird.
There are no insect politicians.
Yeah, as the great Brundlefly told us. So researchers found that 25% of manipulated ladybugs recovered normal behavior following this ordeal.
What? So they got to go around with the memory of this. Good thing they probably don't have episodic memory.
Yeah. They just that also speaks to just the sturdiness of insects, really, to thrive in such a cruel world. You know, you've got to be incredibly resilient. So that's one of my favorite examples of parasitic behavior, parasitic reproduction with organisms.
Well, Robert, I think you're wrong. I think that is an ideal imaginary friend for a child. Because this imaginary friend not only might sting bad guys and monsters, but could enslave another insect to protect you from bad guys and monsters on its behalf.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're kind of terrifying organisms, aren't they? At least if you're a ladybug or, say, a tarantula.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing. I can see, like, some people are afraid of spiders. Well, then if you're afraid of spiders, then you have to be a huge wasp fan because, you know, they go around just terrorizing the bejesus out of spider populations. I don't know if you've ever bust open, as a child, dirt dauber nests.
Oh.
And see, like, all the spiders that they've stuffed in there for their larvae to consume. It's pretty wonderful. All right. But still, as beautiful as these examples are, again, these pale in comparison to the Mona Lisa of parasitic brainwashing.
That's right. Crowd in, get your camera ready. It's time to visit the masterpiece. And so picture this, a carpenter ant colony in a rainforest. You're going to be in maybe the Amazon or in a Thai rainforest. And so you'll see thousands of ants swarming around on the nest or traveling out down the trunk of a tree into foraging trains. But if you look close, one of these ants is not moving along with the others. Instead of moving along in a train or swarming, it's frozen in place. and its body is sort of curling up around itself, almost like it's trying to touch its head to its anus. And it's curling and writhing and pulsing its whole body, and it keeps scraping at its antennae with its forelimbs. Something's obviously wrong with this ant.
Yeah, that doesn't sound right at all.
No. And then finally, it falls from its nest to the forest floor. And from there, it begins to move slowly, almost like it's drunk, sort of crawling around awkwardly, and then eventually up the stalk of a nearby sapling plant. And when it reaches just about 25 centimeters above the forest floor, it aligns its body with the primary vein on the underside of a leaf, and then it clamps down as hard as it can with its mandibles. The ant will never leave this spot. Within a few days, the ant's going to be dead, and its jaws will still be locked onto the vein tissue of this leaf, and a crazy-looking thing will start to happen. A huge spike starts to grow out of a hole in the back of the ant's head, like this gigantic single devil horn, growing longer and longer, longer than the ant itself, until it becomes clear that this spike is a killer mushroom. Mm. It's the fruiting body of a parasitic fungus called Ophiocordyceps unilateralis. Now, there are a lot of species of related entomoparasitic fungi, each targeting a different host organism. Unilateralis specifically targets carpenter ants and their close relatives. Now, you might be wondering, why did that observed behavior take place? Now, remember all the stuff the ant did. To review, the ant becomes infected with the fungal mm-hmm. parasite. It climbs to a leaf 25 centimeters off the forest floor. It clamps on with its mandibles. It dies. And then the fruiting body of the fungus erupts from the ant's head and grows long. So why does the ant go to the leaf? Like, is this just its preferred place to die? It's true that ants are social insects. And Robert, I don't know if you've read this before. Sometimes they will intentionally remove themselves from their colony when they develop an infectious parasite.
I don't know if I've read that before. I've certainly read about them removing infected individuals from the premises.
Yeah, like, that's definitely true. Mm-hmm. When you detect an infection on your fellow ant, it's like, okay, time to go on a trip, buddy. And they carry you out away from where you can infect other ants. But yeah, so you have to be wondering, like, is this some kind of social insect altruistic, act? Is this like the elephant graveyard for sick ants?
Mm-hmm.
No, the truth is a lot creepier. Instead, we should ask, how does the fungus spread? Like, how does it reach new hosts? Well, it spreads by infecting ants with its spores, which are produced by these fruiting bodies, the bulge just below the tip of that fungal head spike, which, the spike is known as the stroma. And what's walking around on the forest floor, the 25 centimeters beneath the dead ant and its head spike? More ants. More hosts. So the ant doesn't climb the leaf because it wants to. The ant climbs the leaf because somehow the fungal infection makes it climb the leaf. The behavior is not for the good of the ant, it's for the good of the fungus.
It's essentially going home. It's reaching higher ground and then saying, take me home, next phase in my my parasitic journey.
Yeah, let us begin the death reign.
Yes.
So the fungus often now gets an additional appellation, not just Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, but Ophiocordyceps unilateralis sensu lato, which for some reason keeps evoking the spirit of like a Tool album name.
It does. It reminds me of lateralis.
Yeah. Sensu lato means broadly speaking in Latin, and this indicates that scientists believe the correct taxonomy of this species and its related cousins of fungi basically have not been fully sorted out yet. Strains of this fungus ultimately might get sorted into different genus and species categories that could change.
Because, yeah, we have a number of Ophiocordyceps and also Cordyceps
I think Cordyceps is like an archaic terminology for, like, Ophiocordyceps used to be known as Cordyceps unilateralis.
Yeah, a number of these species, these particular species, when you look at them, the older studies are just saying Cordyceps as opposed to Ophiocordyceps.
Yeah, so basically there's some taxonomic stuff that's still being worked out.
Yeah.
And so the sensu lato is on there to let you know, like, these words could be different in the future.
Yeah. Now,
someone might be inclined to think that the scientists just realized that everyone had cordyceps down, and they thought, well, we need to make that word a little more complicated. Let's add a few more syllables to the name.
Well, I mean, a lot of people still just say cordyceps when they talk about this. I know I often do. So one of the big researchers in ophiocordyceps has been the entomologist David Hughes at Penn State. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things he points out about this is that it's an example of what Richard Dawkins called the extended phenotype. So in an organism, the phenotype is all of the externally observable characteristics that emerge from that organism's genome acting within its environment. So your personal phenotype includes your hair, your eyes, the shape of your body, your height, but also your behavior. Like, if you like black licorice, that's part of your phenotype. The way you talk is part of your phenotype. But when Dawkins coined the idea of the extended phenotype, he was pointing out that the externally manifested effects of our genes are not only the parts of our body and the behaviors of those parts, but also external effects and artifacts within the environment and even within other organisms. So a beaver's dam is part of the beaver's extended phenotype, and cars and toasters are part of the human phenotype.
But these are all things that these organisms have made out of the natural world.
Right. They are products of that organism's genes interacting with the environment. Mm-hmm. Now, how does this apply to the ophiocordyceps? Well, look at the infected ant. Hughes has written, quote, "While the manipulated individual may look like an ant, it represents a fungal genome expressing fungal behavior through the body of an ant." So if the ant's body is doing the climbing and the clamping, really it's the fungus and its genes that are driving the behavior. This is what you're looking at now is a fungal organism. It just happens to be inside an ant's body.
Yeah, and it's how different it, I mean, it's rather different, but it's, you could compare it to, say, a human being who's wearing an all-leather outfit. You know, they are kind of wearing the carcass of a pig.
Yeah.
It may be a very stylish carcass of a pig.
Uh-huh.
To what extent are they, you're not looking at pure human anymore.
Right. From a sort of like a survival and reproduction point of view, that thing crawling around is fungus.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ant anymore. It's not insect.
Right.
So I just wanted to talk about a few more interesting facts about the ophiocordyceps.
Now, these are previously established facts, right? Or
we're not
getting into any of the new stuff
yet. This is not from the new paper yet. So one of the things is, how does the spore get into the ant's body? We know we've said that there's this, once you create the stroma, mm-hmm. and it's hanging off the leaf and it's raining down, the death rain is falling on the forest floor, it's spreading these spores. But what happens? Well, the spore enters the ant's body by penetrating the cuticle, and it does this with the help of a corrosive enzyme that eats through the ant's tough exoskeleton. So the ant picks up a killer spore from the rain of death zone, and then the spore attaches to the ant, and then it pushes through the ant's exoskeleton with a mix of this solvent enzyme and mechanical force. And then once the fungal cells are inside, they multiply within the fluid of the ant's circulatory system. Now, should we take a pedantic note? Some articles have been using the word blood, like ant blood.
Mm-hmm.
I think even some entomologists would probably say that for shorthand, but there are, we should make clear, differences between vertebrate and insect circulatory systems.
Yes.
So ants and other insects have a very different kind of circulatory system than vertebrates like us do. Insects do not have a closed circulatory system of tube-shaped blood vessels. And they also don't have blood, technically. What they have is known as an open circulatory system, where a pumping organ distributes this heterogeneous fluid around inside the body cavities, and all of the major organs are bathed in this sort of open sea of fluid. As we said, the fluid is not blood, but it's this substance known as hemolymph. And the hemolymph doesn't have red blood cells, so it's not the major way of distributing oxygen throughout the body. Instead, it does distribute nutrients and it does remove waste, but in a slightly less organized fashion than the blood of vertebrates.
But if you want to call it blood, simplicity of explanation, then by all means,
sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, the parasitic fungal cells get into this fluid, and then they multiply inside the ant's body for about 16 to 25 days until they reach the point where they the ant begins to display the characteristic biting behaviors, the mandible clamping of unilateralis infection. The ant bites down on a leaf or another piece of plant matter, usually the main vein on the bottom side of a leaf, with its mandibles, and it doesn't let go. Now, I wanted to mention a few more interesting behavioral facts from a study by a team led by David Hughes that was published in BMC Ecology in 2011. And they studied unilateralis in a Thai rainforest and found that the infected ants, like, one thing you might wonder is, how do they get around, right? Mm-hmm. Does the fungus actually direct them to, like, here, go to that sapling and crawl up? Instead, what they found there is that the infected ants sort of display random walking patterns. It's almost like they're just sort of like trying directions randomly.
Huh.
And if they try to climb back up to their nest in the canopy, convulsions will make them fall off and fall back down to the forest floor. So they're sort of bound to the earth. Now, eventually, this phase of erratic wandering around stops when they find a leaf, and then they do the death grip. So they say, quote, transitions from erratic wandering to death grips on a leaf vein were abrupt and synchronized around solar noon. That's kind of odd.
So if we were to imagine this with a fictional humanoid zombie, it would be like the zombie bumbles around the apartment building until it just happens upon the roof.
Yeah. But once it's there, it's time to get down. Well, I don't know what the equivalent would be. It straps itself to the helicopter landing pad or something. And waits for a helicopter and then uses that to spread its spores as it travels
along. Or just
along.
Breaks into a thriller dance. That might be the final stage. Really, that we're supposed to witness.
There you go. Or does that party from Independence Day on the roof of the skyscraper where they all say welcome?
It could be.
Now, once the ant climbs onto a leaf and locks onto vein tissue with its mandibles, quote, extensive atrophy of the mandibular muscles sets in. And this is kind of interesting. So it gets the ant to bite down and then it attacks the mandibular muscles of the ant to say, like, okay, that's it. You're not doing anything else with these muscles from now on. So it can't really let go. And so it remains stuck to the leaf like that after it dies. And the atrophy seems to be caused by high densities of single-celled stages of the fungus inside the ant's head. So the head fills up with fungal cells. And they make the mandible muscles atrophy away, and then you're just locked on there like a vice.
So this is all pretty terrifying. I mean, there's a reason that this story and all the research that's associated with it keeps grabbing headlines. It keeps influencing, not only our science journalism, but even our fiction. Various film and video game properties have been directly influenced by this fabulous model.
Yeah, I know it's been in some movies. I haven't seen the movies. A strain of the cordyceps fungus is the zombie-creating parasite in the video game The Last of Us, where the basic conceit is that this type of parasite has jumped into human hosts.
Yeah, it's even popped up in Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, yeah?
Where you have a lot of, fungal creatures in the Underdark, and the recent campaign, Out of the Abyss, includes some illustrations and descriptions of particular mind controlled fungi that like take over characters and then eventually cause the mushroom to pop out of the top of their skull.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is it mushroom shaped on the head, or is it more like the stroma we've seen here, like a big spike with maybe a ball toward the end of it?
It was more abstract like that. Yeah. Or at least the illustrations in the book depicted as such. So it's a very inspiring model. And if there had been no further research on it, I think it would have continued to inspire us.
Yeah.
But when we come back from this last break, we will get into this new research that really makes the whole prospect even more terrifying, I think.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better.
because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. All right, we're back.
So what is this recent development in the world of cordyceps fungus? Well, I will say I first found out about this in an article by one of my favorite science writers at The Atlantic, Ed Yong, who wrote about this in November. So we went back and checked this out, and some of our listeners sent us this article and were like, hey, are you ever going to do, you know, an episode on this subject? So I guess that's how we ended up here today.
Yeah.
But believe it or not, the story about the Ophiocordyceps is even creepier than we first realized. I think we've been through a couple of stages of escalating creepiness. So it has been well established that the fungus manipulates the ant's behavior. It forces it to climb up into the air about 25 centimeters over the forest floor and become this possessed spore bomber, just raining death upon the other ants from its colony. But it was not yet understood exactly how the fungus got the ants to follow this complex and highly specified behavior. After all, this isn't exactly something simple. You know, it's not just like make the ant freeze in place so it's vulnerable to predators.
Yeah, or make it want this food instead of that food, that sort of thing.
Or make it run around in random erratic motion. It requires the ant to find the plant stalk, climb up the sapling to a very specific height, and then clamp onto the plant with its mandibles and never let go. That is like weirdly specified behavior, right?
Yeah.
And if I had to guess, I'd assume it did this by invading the brain with its cells and then either mechanically attacking or chemically attacking some brain tissues to trigger a series of instinctual behaviors in the ant to make this take place. Now, there may very well be some of that going on in terms of chemical triggering of behaviors, right? There's a 2017 study by Fredrickson et al. In Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences just this year called Three-Dimensional Visualization of a Deep Learning Model Reveal Complex Fungal Parasite Networks in Behaviorally Manipulated Ants. And in this study, researchers created a 3D model of an ant infected with unilateralis to see what all of the fungal growth was doing inside of the ant's body. So how do they do this? Well, they use scanning electron microscopy. And so this actually involved making very, very thin, I wanted to say paper thin, but much thinner mm-hmm. than paper, ant slices. They took an infected ant and sliced it into segments that were each just about 50 nanometers thick apiece. In Ed Yong's article, he says that the ants were, quote, julienned. I think that was a really amazing word choice. But the thickness of these slices is roughly the length of a single hepatitis virus.
Wow.
So we're talking about seriously thin possessed ant slices. It made me think about that scene with the garlic in Goodfellas.
I've never seen Goodfellas, so yeah, I just assume this is like a torture scene with Joe Pesci, like he's slicing people up like garlic. Or
no,
something.
Oh, that'd be amazing. No, in fact, it's a cooking scene. There's a scene where all the mob bosses are in prison together,
mm-hmm.
Except for them because they pay off the guards and everything. Prison's great, so they just constantly cook and eat delicious food. And the big boss of the mafia in it prepares sauces by slicing garlic with a razor blade. And they talk about how he slices it so thin it would just liquefy in the pan.
Huh. All right. So in this case, though, of course, we're not slicing garlic. We're slicing infected ants.
Uh-huh.
So they repeat this slice and dice number some 2,000 times over a 24-hour period. And along the way, they're capturing images of each slice.
And that's with the scanning electron microscope. So that's giving you incredibly detailed images of very small stuff.
Then they're able to stack these images to create a 3D digital model of the ant. And this is where AI researchers led by Danny Chin, professor of computer science and engineering at University of Notre Dame, enters the picture, busting out artificial intelligence and machine learning algorithms to analyze the images. They basically train computers to tell the difference between fungal and ant cells to just see how much of this organism is ant and how much of it is invading fungus.
You're gonna like the answer. A lot of it is invading fungus, and there are some illustrations. Robert, we'll try to link some of the illustrations
yes.
on our landing page, right? So if you want to go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, check out the landing page. We'll link out to these. These images are terrifying. So they're intramuscular pictures, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you get to see the ant's muscles inside its exoskeleton, and they're just surrounded by these wreaths of fungal cells.
Yeah, like just imagine like tiny, tiny vines growing about around every detail inside the muscle tissue.
There's one picture we've got here that's a 3D reconstruction of the ant mandible adductor muscle,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like it's got, I hate to invoke my favorite, no, I don't hate to, I love to, it's got a crab monster on it. There's a yellow crab monster crawling on this muscle, and what this actually is just this huge collocation of networked fungal cells.
Yeah, so what they basically discovered here is that the fungal cells were present through virtually all regions of the host ant's body in a way that suggested they might be interconnected as well, networked even. And what's more, the stuff was clustered just outside the brain, but they didn't seem to be any in the brain, which makes you question a lot of these ideas about brain control, mind control within the ant.
I mean, that's almost the exact opposite of what I would have thought.
Right.
I would have thought that you'd see most of these cells in the brain, invading the brain tissue or central nervous tissue to control the behavior. I wouldn't expect to see it so much in, you know, the legs and the mandibles and all that.
Yeah, but again, this is the Mona Lisa of mind control parasites. One of the things that Young points out in his article is that other brain parasites, not only do they get into the brain, but in some cases they destroy the brain to change an organism's behavior. Or he points out a flatworm that, quote, forms a carpet-like layer over the brain of the California killifish, leaving the brain intact while forcing the fish to behave erratically and draw the attention of birds.
Mm.
So, this is something entirely more complex going on. But it does force us to reconsider the previous notion that this was more of just a straight-up mind control, a hijacking of the brain. Now, certainly, this isn't – they're not saying that there's not some reprogramming of behavior going on here.
Right. That could very well be happening chemically, right?
Right. There's some sort of chemical – process probably going on. But there's also this network extending throughout the body.
I mean, we keep saying mind control. That's probably an unscientific term.
Yeah.
I know I've used it, and that's not quite the right – what we should be saying for scientific accuracy is behavior control.
Yes.
Because, you know, who wants to say what the mind of an ant is when possessed by this thing? Though we might speculate a little bit on that in a second. but, yeah, if it's not mind control, is it more like body control?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about the brain here is that the researchers hypothesized that the creature's captive brain, essentially captive, think about that, this network has moved throughout the body, taken over the body, and the brain is just preserved in there like it's a Mego brain canister in a Lovecraft story. But it's preserved so that it can perform the final act that is necessary, biting onto the vegetation and then never letting go.
Wow.
Yeah. So what's worse, the parasitic organism that destroys your brain to control your body, or the parasitic organism that holds off and says, no, we're not done with you yet. We have one more thing for you to do.
This is one of those findings that's so cool. I am afraid it's going to be subject to the retraction in a year or something, just because doesn't that always happen, you know?
They're going to put feathers on our dinosaur.
No. Like in a year, it'll be like, no. Really, it is just chemical alteration of the brain. Mm-hmm. And they're not really controlling the muscles so directly. But for now, this is glorious. And I hope it's true. I hope this is the correct analysis.
I have a wonderful quote from David Hughes here. Again, he's the associate professor of entomology and biology at Penn State, who's been doing all this wonderful research with this particular fungus. And he said in the press release, "We found that a high percentage of the cells in a host were fungal cells. In essence, these manipulated animals were a fungus in ants' clothing." So That's quite a vision.
So to speculate about being inside the ant's mind, if there were such a thing.
Yeah, as impossible as it is to try and think as an ant and to imagine the ant's experience, what would that be like? Would it be like you're locked inside your body and your body is doing things and you're also like behaviorally you're modified as well. You want to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're still able to think, I guess. Again, this is all anthropomorphic complexity when we try and imagine what an ant thinks.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, oh man, it's just so nightmarish.
Fortunately, this could never happen in a human being, right?
Well, one would hope. Not outside of a video game, right?
Yeah, you would hope. And I think that there's no good reason to think that, that a fungus like this could parasitize humans. But if we just want a hint of that kind of creepiness, mm-hmm. let's try. Most parasites, it is true, have highly specified life cycles where they're really closely associated with their host organism. But Ophiocordyceps fungi have been documented performing amazing, quote, host jumps.
Oh.
Not just to different species, not just to different arthropods, but even across literally kingdoms of life.
Jeez.
Yeah. So a 2000 study in the Journal of Molecular Biology and Evolution by Naru Niko and Takema Fukatsu found that though most species of – back then they were calling it cordyceps fungus.
Yes.
Though most of these were adapted to arthropod hosts like insects and spiders and so forth, at the time about 20 of the known 300 species were parasitic not to arthropods but to Hart's truffles. Truffles, mushrooms. Like Hart's truffles are fungi of the genus Elaphomyces. Huh? So using phylogenetic analysis, they discovered that the parasites of the Hart's truffles were originally, long ago, parasites of cicada nymphs.
Oh, man.
Quote, "The common habitats of cicada nymphs and Hart's truffles, deep underground and associated with tree roots, suggest that the inter-kingdom host jumping from animalia to fungi may have been promoted by the overlapping ecological niche of the unrelated hosts."
I mean, this is so crazy. This is like if someone came to you and they said, "Hey, there's something wrong with one of the ferns That I'm growing in my home. Well, what's wrong with your ferns? It has tapeworms. Like you would just say, no, that's impossible. Tape, we know where tapeworms reside. They are not going to jump over into another kingdom entirely and start wreaking havoc there.
Yeah, you normally wouldn't see things like this because a parasite needs to be specified to its host. Like how would it even work in a body as different from an ant's as say like a mammal's? So you really hopefully don't have to expect anything like that happening.
It's an example where nature really throws you for a curve here, just illustrating what is possible.
So
let the nightmares fly, I guess, but don't become too paranoid over it.
I will say there's one thing working in our favor, which is that I read that the Ophiocordyceps fungus itself is subject to fungal parasitism.
Oh, okay.
So there is a hyperparasite, which is the name for a parasite that parasitizes a parasite.
Yes.
A hyperparasite fungus that attacks Ophiocordyceps, and Ophiocordyceps has to have defensive measures to protect itself against this fungal parasite.
Oh, wow. Parasites within parasites within parasites.
Yeah, it's parasites all the way down.
You know, as we close out here, I do want to mention another favorite parasite of mine that is also an Ophiocordyceps, Ophiocordyceps sinensis, which imagine a number of our listeners have run across this before, especially if you have visited a Chinese apothecary shop or just traveled in the East in general.
I think this one used to just be called Cordyceps sinensis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is one where you find it's been studied a lot. There are a lot of papers on it, and most of the papers are a little older and refer to it as Cordyceps sinensis. It's native to the mountains of Tibet and Nepal, where it parasitizes larvae of ghost moths and produces a fruiting body, much like these other Cordyceps that we've discussed. It's often described there as a root that's allegedly half vegetable and half caterpillar, and it's exported as an energy booster and an aphrodisiac. So according to Lonely Planet, the Tibetans call it Yartsa Gumbu, but it's highly prized in traditional Chinese medicine, where it's known as Dongcheng Zai Chao, or winter worm summer grass, also known as the Himalayan Viagra. And you'll see it used in like a ginseng-like tonic, and the tonic is sometimes used to strengthen the body or used in the treatment of kidney and lung problem. Now, there are a number of papers out there that look at the alleged medical properties of this organism. I have not really researched it myself yet. I haven't dived into that particular area of the research. So that's something we could come back to at some point if we wanted to on the show.
Yeah, I wonder what potential there is.
Yeah, it would be interesting to tease it apart in the future for sure.
Or to get inside it and erupt from the back of its head.
Yeah. So speaking of which, I just glanced over at our producer, Alex, and there is a small crack in the top of his skull. A fruiting body is beginning to emerge from it. So I think that means we're out of time.
Man, Alex does good work. That's a talented parasite.
Yeah, he just works right through it. He's committed. All right. In the meantime, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's our mothership. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes. Going back to the beginning of time, you'll find blog posts, videos, links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram. Facebook is where you'll find that lovely discussion module. It's a closed group that you can join and chat with other listeners as well as your hosts. Oh, and if you want to support the show, a great way to do it is to leave us a positive review. Give us stars or whatever the rating symbol happens to be at whatever system you use to listen to the podcast.
Yeah, give us a nice Yelp review.
Yes. But hey, you can also get in touch with us the old-fashioned way.
Oh, that's right. And we should also mention, you should check out the landing page for today's episode, where we're going to link to some images and articles we referenced in the episode. But like he said, if you want to get in touch with us by email, it's blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. We'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.